Ángeles.
Natural beauty, you know. Yeah, no, I never been someone shy.
Do it, yo. Let the beat themselves to me. Do it. Get the big song and lock on the street. Do it, yo.
I am in. I'm gonna play it one more time. I tell the return to all the princess, all the queen, all the mothers. We're gonna rock the world.
No, I never been someone shy until I seen your eyes. Still I had to try.
Well, round and good at them.
Natural beauty. No, I never been someone shy until I seen your eyes. Still I had to try.
My people,
yeah. Oh yes, let me get my words right. And then
and told you
when I'll treat you
like a man used to.
Stop. You'll never have to cry.
No, we don't know.
One can relate to when they find a special someone.
Hey, Sampalo!
She's whoa, royal, whoa. Yeah, so royal. And I want her in my life.
Waiting under the girl I'm uptown.
I never know anyone.
She know who's who.
So one of a kind. No, the way she moves to her own beat. She has the qualities of a queen. She's a queen. Ooh, ooh.
Stop reaching out to Nicole uptown and say, go and pick up yourself every time you had your whole career, see?
To be a cutie, she's a queen.
Want to tell them, say?
She's a queen. And when they ask what a good woman's made of, she's not afraid and ashamed of who she
is.
She's royal.
I tell you, I'm gonna be out of here. Next week, same place, same time. Wake up on yourself. You gotta get some more tune. I'm telling you, the line gonna open next week. So right now, we're gonna pass it over to After Hour. Take it like this.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing. On. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news I'm brought to you live.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show, a part of CKUT's Off the Hour. Prison Radio has been on the air for more than 10 years. Prison Radio seeks to incarceration, policing, and criminal by challenging our ideas about what are prisons and the people inside our jails. Prison Radio is dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. This is in the interest of forging stronger ties with incarcerated and non-incarcerated people, ensuring that prisoners have direct control over their representation, and that our understanding of prisons be informed by those who live inside their walls. We invite anyone who is interested in collaborating on programming to contact us. Those who have been affected by the prison system in any way are encouraged to get involved. You can email news@cqt.ca or prison@cqt.ca, or you can call us at 514-448-4041, extension 6788. You're listening to CQUT, Montreal Community Campus Radio, located on 90.3 FM on the dial, and www.cqut.ca online.
Hello. You're listening to The Prison Radio Show. My name is Noah.
And my name is Yasmin.
And we'll be your hosts for today. On the show today, we'll be rebroadcasting an interview from Rust Belt Abolition Radio about ableism and how it relates to prisons and disabled people who are incarcerated. The interview features conversations with Liat Ben-Moshe and Leroy Moore. We'll also be airing a piece about Operation Push, a resistance effort to end slave labor in prison. As most of you know, February is Black History Month, and on today's episode of Prison Radio Show, as with many of our shows during the rest of the year, we feature the voices and work by Black activists on the inside and on the outside. But in doing so, we also want to recognize the reality that Black people are deliberately and disproportionately targeted by every aspect of the prison industrial system in both the United States and Canada, including but not limited to racial profiling, police brutality, rates of incarceration, abuse and unjust treatment inside prison, racist treatment in the court systems, and what is often referred to as the school-to-prison pipeline. And that this and the importance of talking about it absolutely must not and cannot be limited to Black History Month.
We'll also be featuring an interview with one of the organizers of Masi Mari, the LGBTQ film for art and film that's coming up this month in Montreal. So stay tuned.
As we often do, we will start the show off with some news.
Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale has appointed a new correctional investigator, Ivan Zinger, is now in the position. Zinger worked as the interim correctional investigator since Howard Saper stepped down in November 2016. Zinger cut his teeth in the mid-90s, responding to the aftermath of the Arbor Report about the use of force, segregation practices, and strip searches conducted in Kingston's prison for women. He completed a PhD on the psychological effects of solitary confinement on prisoners. In the report of the Office of the Correctional Investigator for 2016-2017, Zinger pushed for the CSC to bring back a program that allows prisoners to tattoo each other, called for an updated evaluation of the use of ion scanning machines on visitors to the federal penitentiaries, and said he wants to see the Prison Farms program brought back.
According to an article that ran in the Ottawa Citizen by Jared Shook, an activist, ex-prisoner, and University of Ottawa criminology student, the federal court has rejected the lawsuit brought by federal prisoners regarding the Correctional Services of Canada wage cut from 2013. The judge, Yvan Roy, said that the court's purpose was not to, quote, consider the wisdom of the policy decisions made by the government. Shook went on to say that prisoners have now exhausted nearly every reasonable and peaceful mechanism available within the system to seek a remedy to the legitimate concerns presented regarding this policy decision of the former government.
Political prisoners Rashid Johnson faced retaliation for writing about the Operation Push, the currently ongoing work strike in the Florida system. Johnson wrote a piece called Florida Prisoners Are Laying It Down and was placed in a cell with no heat in retaliation with temperatures outside approaching 0 degrees. After outside organizers called the prison, Johnson was allowed to see his lawyer and confirmed that he was in better health. On February 5th, Florida prisoners held in a closed management system joint operation push by boycotting commissary. Folks in the CMU are locked up 23 hours a day, are not allowed any movement, and are subject to communication restrictions. Operation Push has been ongoing since January 15th, and prisoners are demanding an end to slave labor in prison, an end to outrageous canteen prices, and a reintroduction of parole incentives to lifers. For more information, visit incarceratedworkers.org. We'll also be hearing more about Operation Push a bit later in the show.
Before that, however, we're going to be rebroadcasting a piece from our friends at Rust Belt Abolition Radio about ableism and incarceration. The piece features conversations with Dr. Liat Ben-Moshe, Assistant Professor of Disability Studies at the University of Toledo and co-editor of the book Disability Incarcerated, Imprisonment and Disability in the United States and Canada, as well as Leroy Moore, artist and activist and co-founder of Crip Hop and Sins Invalid.
Welcome to Rust Belt Abolition Radio. My name is Andres. In this episode, Carceral Ableism and Disability Justice, we explore the ways in which the framework of carceral ableism redraws our map of racial capitalism's archipelago of confinement and how the liberatory praxis of disability justice works to extend and deepen the abolitionist horizon. We speak first with Dr. Liat Ben-Moshe, Assistant Professor of Disability Studies at the University of Toledo and co-editor of Disability Incarcerated, Imprisonment and Disability in the United States and Canada. Ben-Moshe explains how ableism, the violent material and discursive ordering of bodily and psychic difference through which normative and deviant body minds are produced, has been foundational to the development of the carceral state. We then turn to Leroy Moore, disability justice artist, activist, and co-founder of Crip Hop and Sins Invalid. Moore explains how the disability justice movement emerged as both extension and critique of the disability rights movement, emphasizing the leadership of queer, gender non-conforming people of color with disabilities, and asserting that resisting ableism requires far more than civil rights-oriented legislative reform or police sensitivity trainings. That disability justice means a complete revolutionizing of our conceptions of embodiment and of our practices of interdependence.
I'm A. Maria, here with Alejo Stark, and you're listening to Rust Belt Abolition Radio, an abolitionist media and movement-building project based in Detroit, Michigan.
Last year, A. Maria made a trip to Ohio to speak with Dr. Liat Ben-Moshe, Assistant Professor of Disability Studies at the University of Toledo, and an activist who writes extensively about prison abolition and carceral ableism. She's a co-editor of Disability Incarcerated, Imprisonment and Disability in the United States and Canada.
Dr. Ben-Moshe's work was central to the first episode of Rust Belt Abolition Radio, and she opened the second year of the show by reintroducing disability justice in relation to abolition.
What I think is really important is that when we think about abolition as only tearing down, what it leads us is to what James Kilgore calls carceral humanism, and I would call carceral ableism, really. It's this idea that we can make a more humane kind of carceral state, we can rehabilitate prisoners, we can create psychiatric wards within prisons, because we know that the rate of prisons with disabilities is incredibly high. We can, you know, do things that kind of alleviate the suffering of people right now in terms of the current prison conditions. And one of the things that's problematic with that approach alone is exactly this difference between tearing down and building anew. So rehabilitation is also imbued in this kind of carceral logics, because we know from people who are kind of med survivors, for example, or psychiatric survivors, people who identify as mad, crazy, consumers, ex-patients, anti-psychiatry, these are all kind of different definitions that people might kind of umbrella under. They tell us that for a lot of them, forced medication, for example, hospitalization, these are also imbued within the same kind of carceral logics that try to rehabilitate the productive citizen, which is, of course, you know, based on white, settler, male, able-bodied, straight, you know, all these kind of norm-inducing ideas of what productive means. And so to create this kind of model citizens through rehabilitation, and this is something that we also know from scholars who've done work on the connection between prison and settler colonialism, especially in the U.S., is that the work of rehabilitation is the work of the settler state, right? I mean, the point is to rehabilitate a savage, to create this kind of modern, educated citizen, which is never the indigenous, never the person of color, never the disabled person, and so on. And of course, not the intersections of all these. And so if we understand rehabilitation as that, it's a form of violence. And so this is not an alternative to incarceration. This is a form of a carceral logic. And so if we connect that to Du Bois, again, we should really be cautious about the difference between creating anew and reproducing the old. The point is not to assimilate people into the society as it is now. The point is to completely change what we have now, including abolishing systems like racism and capitalism, which is something that rights movements not necessarily are prepared to do, especially with capitalism and settler colonialism, maybe racism too. And so if a rights movement is more about kind of fighting for the rights to employment for people with disabilities, I would say disability justice would be kind of more concerned about people's value, regardless of whether or not they're employed. So this idea of going beyond the productive citizen, that's more out of the purview of disability rights movement. And I would say that a critical disability perspective from disability studies is kind of the scholarship around all of these issues. So it doesn't mean that it can't be activist, But, you know, what disability studies, I think, does really, really well is to talk about how disability is constructed by the social. And the social could also be economical. The social could also be geographical. The social could also be environmental and all of those connections. But it's to convey that disability is not in people. It's not in people. It's not in minds and it's not in bodies. It's in the interface of those things with environments and societies and cultures and histories. The idea that disability is not inferior. So difference by itself does not need to be in a hierarchy. So if we just had disability kind of by itself, in which people were just different, I don't think we would be having this kind of conversation even, right? The fact is that disability is in a hierarchy by which able-bodiedness or able-mindedness is definitely superior to disability. And that is the problem. And that is the problem that we seek to abolish. So what disability studies does really well is to connect to movements who see disability as a form of identity and pride, take pride in their identity. And it doesn't mean that they every day wake up and say, oh, I'm disabled and beautiful and proud and everything is sunny and roses and I get all the services I need and I live a happy life. No. But it's really, I think, radical to think about disability as beautiful and to think about disability as part of biodiversity and to think about disability as something that we can be proud of, even if we not always are. You know, just we're not always proud of being queer. We're not always proud of being women, and sometimes it's shitty.
What are a couple examples of the intersections between race and disability as well as imprisonment?
Absolutely. That's a great question. And we're close to Flint, you know, is just one example of what's going on right now in terms of population of people of color, poor people that are going to have very high rates of disability, unfortunately, because of lead-based poisoning. This is just one example out of so, so many that are connecting the intersection of race and disability. And there's a lot of course, historical connections of that kind. In an article that I did with Jean Stewart, we talk a lot about that intersection, especially in regards to environmental induced disabilities and prisons. So we talk about a few examples of particular prisons that were built on sites that were known to be environmentally toxic and the kind of production of disability that happens because of, you know, the legacy of the toxicity of those sites. And this is going to affect people's lives for a very long time, sometimes even generationally.
How does the devaluation of disabled people, because of their supposedly non-productive embodiment, connect to racial capitalism's rendering of particular populations as surplus or redundant from the vantage point of capital?
The reason why I think it's really important to understand it from those angles is because, you know, as a disability studies scholar and as an activist, I think we understand disability a little bit differently maybe than the way a lot of people understand disability. And I think the way a lot of people understand disability is an impairment, as something that makes you not being able to do something. And the way that we understand disability within disability justice, disability studies, is that disability is really in the interaction between people and their environment. So for a lot of us, we wouldn't be disabled if it weren't for environmental barriers that are put in place. And these barriers could be capitalism, but it could also be people's attitudes. And it can also be not having ramps or not having interpreters or not having everybody speak sign language or communicating only orally or all these kind of things that we decided as a society that we are going to do. So this is not something in people's bodies, but it's the connection between people's bodies and the societies in which they live and the environments in which we live. So for example, you know, people who talk to themselves in certain cultures, this is considered a sign of being closer to some kind of deity or god. Not to romanticize any of this, but of course, if somebody would do that, like in this society, we incarcerate them. So our responses to the exact same behavior that people have are very different culturally and also very different across time and geographical areas and so on. And so if we understand both race and disability in this kind of way as being socially constructed, I think it's really important to talk about that intersection as well. So I'm really interested in talking about, of course, the intersection of impairment and race, but also the intersection of disability and race as a cultural marker. And in both of those ways, they're both devalued. this really leads us to think about the surplus populations that you mentioned. So if we take that to understand disability and race as being socially constructed, well, often within capitalist societies, which of course is what we live in, not just capitalism, but racial capitalism and settler racial capitalism in the US case, then we can think about how do we reproduce disability and race, especially their intersection, as a kind of burden on society. And when we think about who are like the burdens on society, right, the quote unquote disposable bodies, and I'm saying burden, of course, with quotations, I don't really mean that, but I mean from the point of view of settler racial capitalism, well, these are the unproductive, right, that we talked about earlier, the need of the state to make people productive. So the unproductive would be people of color, particularly men of particular age. And we know that they are worth much more to the gross domestic product when they are in prison, occupying prison beds. And it doesn't matter if the prison, by the way, is for profit or not. The same logic happens in both. So it's not just about private prisons. But they're worth more to the gross domestic product if they're in prison than they are when they're not. And the same is true for people with disabilities. And of course, people who are disabled of color, where they're worth more in nursing homes and in institutions and in prisons than they are in their own beds. This is what Martha Russell called handy capitalism. It's a great kind of, great in quotes, alchemy that capitalism does, where it makes the unproductive into super productive. And we created this whole industry of both, of course, the prison industrial complex, but also the institutional industrial complex and also the health industry. You know, what are social workers, for example, case managers, occupational therapists, all these professions that are built on the backs of people with disabilities, a lot of whom are, of course, people of color. And I'm not saying these are not professions to be had. I'm not saying people don't deserve, if they need to, you know, to go to an occupational therapist or something like that. But what I'm saying is that it's really interesting that those are the people we see as burden, and yet they bring so much profit into the economy at large. And if they didn't exist, we didn't have all these other professions. So that's kind of a really interesting dynamic that we often don't talk about.
Thank you so much for your work, for joining us, and for being a great friend of the show.
Kom her fra flokken som loven og broren og sender sveste tog innan grås Nord i vesten stegs noen glugglisten og flukten de frukter her dæve Ut om sånn spøkoholik, hva psykoholik? Så vi gir vorn fra oss vann og dikt Det kom til sån Vi har ordet litt til kust Så det var teit som skier en raven Sen sån befreit sig rebelliert i bokstaden Det var et sikt som er stilt En der de sa om ikke Atheist en glauben stark om pacifist Dystrofisk, progressiv, beeindrektig Poesi, filosofisk, kan ha en svær gewicht
That was Sugar Free Queen by Crip Bop Nation. At the 2017 International Conference on Penal Abolition, ICOPA, Amari and I caught up with musician, journalist, and Sinsin Valley co-founder, Leroy Moore. Sinsin Valley is a performance project that incubates and celebrates artists with disabilities, centralizing artists of color and queer and gender-bearing artists. Also a co-founder of Crip Bop Nation, a collective of hip-hop artists and other musicians with disabilities, Leroy tackles police violence against disabled people of color in his music as well as his organizing.
I'm the black cripple. aka Leroy Moore. I'm from the Bay Area. I'm a poet, journalist, activist with Poor Magazine. I also do what's called Crip Hop Nation with a K. Also write for the San Francisco Bay View newspaper. I've been on the lecture circuit in colleges since 98.
Can you speak about how you think about the relationships between your cultural work, disability justice, and abolition?
Disability justice really came from on a group of people of color in the Bay Area, led by few people that are queer, people that are trans, people that were being left out of the disability rights movement. Matter of fact, in the 90s with Poor Magazine and the San Francisco Bay View newspaper, we were on a campaign that lasted 3-4 years of proving that Michael Manning was there, wrote a judge and mocked his disability in court. The judge called him the N-word and all that stuff. He was in jail for like 4 or 5 years, and Poor Magazine and myself and San Francisco Bay View, wrote articles. We were in touch with the family. I went down there twice to see him. We finally got in contact with Hurricane Carter. He switched his whole case around. The DA was racist. The DA was mocking his disability, just like the judge. So that's only one case.
Can you tell us about the cultural work of Sins Invalid, the performance project which has been at the forefront of articulating, embodying, and disseminating the politic of disability justice?
Patty and I started like 10 years ago. We just had the questions about not seeing people of color with disabilities in the artistic world in the Bay Area. We wanted to be for people of color, people that are queer, people that are transgender, and it really had an artistic frame on it with a political lens.
So, Leroy, can you tell us more explicitly what abolition means to you?
I think it goes way beyond reform, it goes way beyond policy. It's just take down the whole system. People have the answers, not politicians. There's other ways to get justice, other ways that our Native Americans taught us, before we had, institutional policies. We need to go back to those types of ways.
Can you talk about the San Francisco Bay View and the close lines of contact that it keeps with people who are incarcerated?
The Bay View in San Francisco is, I think, one of the oldest black-owned newspapers in the Bay Area. And it's political, it's straightforward. There's no mainstream Fox News kind of bullshit. We tell it like it is. And, because of that, of course, people in authority roles don't want the Bay View to be in their institution. We have articles like from Omea to, disabled people living on the streets. So it's not surprising that it's banned.
Can you talk about some of the intersections between gentrification and police violence, specifically in terms of violence against people of color with disabilities?
People with disabilities in the Bay Area and in New York, come on, you can't work $5,000 a month. We're really on SSI. That's unheard of. So a lot of people with disabilities are becoming homeless once again, or getting into the prison system, especially people with mental health disabilities. In the Bay Area, in Oakland, they wanted to build a mental health jail. And most of the people that's locked up are people that are brown and have disabilities. I've been involved with police brutality since 88. It's mind-blowing because 70% of cases are around police brutality are people with disabilities. The cycle of what happens when police brutality happens with people with disabilities It's a cycle that's been going on since the 80s. Cycle is, you know, a person with a disability is abused. I believe the first thing that comes out is the police side of the story that taints everything. And a lot of times the disability is like erased. You don't even know. But after it's erased and after the court case, the only one solution that's been around since 89 is more police training. Can you imagine if our community got the training, but you don't have to call the police? You know, we really need to change the focus of what the police needs to what the community needs.
Well, thank you so much for taking all this time and speaking with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
The foundational imbrications of ableism and the carceral state are evident not only in the marked overrepresentation of disabled people within formal sites of incarceration and among the survivors of police violence, but moreover in the forms of surveillance, discipline, and confinement that structure a host of institutions typically understood as outside the purview of the carceral state, such as nursing homes, psychiatric institutions, and rehabilitation centers among them. Moore turns our attention to the generative relationship between disability justice and abolition. If abolition means creating a world in which, as Ruth Wilson Gilmore puts it, there is no boundary or border used to keep somebody in or somebody out, then abolition must be the practice of dismantling the violent walls erected by ableism and imagining a world in which a great diversity of body minds can flourish.
Thanks for tuning in. You can listen to past episodes on our website at www.rustbeltradio.org. This show was co-produced by the Rust Belt Abolition Radio crew. Andres, A. Maria, David Langstaff, Catalina Rios, Cape Syed, and Alejo Stark. Original music by Bad Infinity.
That was a piece we rebroadcast from Rust Belt Abolition Radio about ableism, disability, and incarceration, featuring interviews with Dr. Liat Ben-Moshe and Leroy Moore of Crip Hop Nation and Sins Invalid. The full episode and transcript of the piece can be found at rustbeltradio.org. We'll also post a link to it on our website.
On Friday, February 23rd, join us for a benefit for La Centre des Femmes Incest Survivor Program, featuring Strange Fruits, La Fièvre, Stranger Familiar, and Fées d'Hiver at La Vitrola, 4602 Saint-Laurent. Doors are at 8 p.m. and the music starts at 9 p.m. sharp. Tickets are only $10. That's Friday, February 23rd at La Vitrola, a benefit for La Centre des Femmes. With the kind support of Festival Lux Magna and Casa del Popolo, a CKUT co-presentation.
This Valentine's Day at the Native Friendship Center, Missing Justice invites you to a community gathering to honor the lives and memories of women, Two-Spirit, and non-binary people who have been lost to gendered and racialized violence. This ninth annual event will include performances by Nina and Sierra Sakalowitz, the Buffalo Head Singers, Marie-Josée Tremblay, and more. There will also be time for people in attendance to share a song, a story, a dance, a poem, or any expression to honor those who have been lost. Tea, sweets, and bannock will also be served, and there is no cost to attend. That's Wednesday, February 14th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Native Friendship Center, corner of Ontario and Saint Laurent. Join us. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
The time is presently 5:33 p.m. and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca.
Next up on the show, we have a piece from the Oakland Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee about Operation Push, a prisoner-led resistance effort in protest of slave labor and other prison conditions.
You are listening up front. I am Kat Brooks. This is another segment of Police, Power, and Prisons. On Martin Luther King Jr. Day, where across the country, folks were reclaiming the radical legacy of Dr. King, inmates in the state of Florida launched Operation Push,
refusing to work until a series of demands are met. The Florida Department of Corrections has denied any strikes are happening, while solidarity organizations are relaying stories of widespread retaliation. Joining us this morning to discuss is an organizer with Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. Good morning, Brooke.
Hey, good morning. Good to be here.
Thank you so much for coming. Why choose MLK to launch the strike?
That would be a good question to ask the organizers, but there's been a total communications blackout.
What does that mean for our listeners?
Oh, well, it started even before the strike occurred. Communications blackout means taking all leadership they can get their hands on and throwing them into solitary, shutting down state-run phone systems, throwing all the mail in the trash, canceling weekend visitations, and generally bringing in the gang investigations unit to take anyone and everyone they could get their hands on to bring them in for interrogation and threaten them with gang validation unless they fessed up.
Now, I don't know about the other things, but isn't throwing mail in the trash illegal? There's laws that protect prisoners' rights to receive
mail. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But if anyone that has any interaction with the prison system, especially on any political level or... That's a fiction, that any of that gets respected. Legal mail gets opened oftentimes. Talk to any prison advocate that on the outside, a legal rep, and they'll tell you about stories about their legal mail being opened and being re-glued. All kinds of stuff gets, depending on the security classification of the prisoner, oftentimes gets rerouted to gang investigation units where it's even, like, chemically tested or basically just scanned. And, like, the law... often states that you have to get a refusal notice if something is banned or refused, and then either end gets it returned or refusal notice. That's not the case. There's generally just a big black hole when communications are cut off. No DOC respects any of its laws, including the Federal Bureau of Prisons.
Backing up just a minute, what are the demands of those that are striking in Florida?
The three core demands that were evolved. I mean, first, let's say this prisoner group is remarkable because there are individuals and leadership in Florida that are still in solitary from the national prison strike in 2016. There are still leadership and prisoners still in solitary from August 19th, the Millions for Prisoners Day of Action that was called nationwide. This group of prisoners came out of nowhere. Like, no one knew who they were, and we got contact with them in November. And they had basically a disparate set of demands, and then discussions started, and they hammered out three basic demands that are basically statewide demands. One, they want pay for work. Florida is one of the states where you can still be compelled to work with no pay whatsoever. Texas is another.
Wait, compelled to work.
Compelled to work.
What happens to you if you just sit down and won't work?
Refusing a work assignment means you automatically get your privileges revoked. And there are different classifications of privileges. In California, there's like A, B, and C. A means you get your full commissary amount, you get your full like visitation rights, and you get certain phone calls. Refuse a work assignment, you know, you instantly go to like what's called classification C, where you get one phone call a month, you get one third of commissary, you get no visitation, and everything's yanked back just about to zero. It's one step above solitary.
Wow.
So this myth that it's voluntary labor is a complete farce. Mm-hmm. You know, even though jobs are sought after in some ways, in some states, because it offers you some remuneration and some relief from basically the boredom and violence of the dormitories, they can compel you to work very easily. And that's just on the books regulations. In every facility, there's another layer of regulation that individual wardens can institute, and basically state regs give you a big window so that they can add additional ones. Then there's what's called off-the-book regs, which every prisoner, every guard, every warden, every person within the prison knows about. Those are the unwritten rules and, like, repercussions that come down when you don't step in line. So, like, this is just on-the-book regulations we're talking about. The off-the-book ones can be just as harsh. You know, all the 1,000 acts of basically arbitrary discipline and punishment that happen within prisons don't happen on paper. They happen off the books. So if you even refuse a work assignment, you can face all kinds of hell from guards, administration, you know, the mailroom even. Just like, you won't get those packages. You won't get this. You won't get that. Everything will get lost. You know, all the little ways, all these functionaries are given arbitrary authority, they're going to exercise it. Second demand, they want an end to price gouging. So even with like zero to like very small wages paid for these jobs, or oftentimes in Florida, they'll get what's called gain time. They'll get like points towards release or like a fraction of the time worked towards release. They don't want that because that's something that can be taken away. That's another off-the-book reg that can be taken away for discipline.
And that's in lieu of any cash wages, any credit on your
compensary. Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Some jobs do like receive like 16 cents, 30 cents an hour, depends. But they in Florida is one of the states that they doesn't have to pay you anything. Straight up chain gang. They want basically an end to the price gouging. So even with that possibility of wages or commissary money coming in, a case of soup that you will pay $4 for on the outside, like Top Ramen's, you'll pay $17 for from the commissary. And when you're making 0 to 8 cents an hour, if you even have a job, that's astronomical. And Florida, you know, is their prison systems across the country are basically uniform in their purpose and their intent. But in terms of their management styles, they vary. California is a very professionalized, codified one. But Florida is a regressive, like parochial, straight up push your face in the dirt. We're going to kill you kind of system. So in lieu of that, they'll just, you know, one of those privileges, like they'll restrict your commissary if you refuse work down to a third of the amount that you're regulated. You know, which could be like $20, which means you go from ability to feed yourself, because Florida in their system, they feed you toxic filth for food. They do not feed you enough in order to maintain your health. It's necessary for commissary, you know, food in order to even maintain your well-being. And that's with no special needs whatsoever, or even like just like 50th percentile, 160-pound, like, you know, man or woman. So third demand. They want a restoration of parole considerations for lifers and those what they call Buck Rogers dates. People with like parole possibilities that are like 50, 75, 150 years in the future. It's basically a de facto life without parole. They want a restoration of parole and incentives for that to be brought back on the table. There are some other concerns that they listed, basically overcrowding, brutality, and all the things that I just basically mentioned to you. But those three core demands are what this kind of disparate group of like new prisoners to organizing basically hammered out between each other.
And so how long is Operation Push supposed to last, and what are they doing?
It's always very hard to tell because of the aforementioned communications blackout.
Right.
Especially since the interrogations and the threats and the gang validation and the solitary started weeks before the strike even happened. So FDOC is claiming nothing is happening. That's a lie. That's completely false and expected. We've gotten reports so far confirmed of 16 facilities with confirmed work stoppages, laydowns, or refusing movement. It was basically called to be a laydown for 30 days. That's very optimistic because, I mean, you always call it big and then see what you can pull off. They started with like 8 facilities in their initial call out where they had representatives where they could be confirmed. Now other prisoner organizing networks basically picked up the call and said like 100% let's go. We've gotten confirmed reports from 16 facilities of some form of activity, whether it's just refusing canteen or phone or refusing movement or food. Or, you know, refusing work assignments. Not everyone has a job to strike on, but you can strike on everything else.
To your point, we actually did reach out to the Florida Department of Corrections and invited them to come onto the show, and this is what they wrote back. We spoke with your colleague yesterday. The information you're receiving is inaccurate. There have been no, capital N-O, inmates on strike or inmates participating in work stoppages. Despite reports from media that the strike would happen, it did not occur. Why is it so important for the DOC to deny that this is happening?
Well, this is standard practice. You know, you approach anyone with this level of like brutality, and they're given arbitrary authority. Prison is basically constructed to be a form of oblivion, a black hole. And even ideologically, in society at large, it's a place of removing certain considerations. It's separated, oftentimes very physically separated from the rest of society, such as we have in California, where jails are intentionally placed in the hinterlands or along isolated stretches in the Central Valley or Pelican Bay, you know, which is like 8 hours drive north. So like conceptually and ideologically and politically, of course, like it mirrors the actual physical geography of the system. It mirrors the power relationship of prisons within, you know, within government. You know, they're the largest agency in just about every single state. California, it's an $11+ billion agency, the largest state agency within the state government. So like what political imperative, what power relationship is there to enforce any truth telling? They don't have to answer to anyone. Anyone. You know, they've basically been given a full mandate. So I never expect the truth from them. So like, it's on us basically to free ourselves from those blinders and stop even listening to them. You know, this is patently absurd. You know, even the Department of Justice statistics on deaths in Florida, deaths spiked 20% last year. 428 prisoners died in custody in Florida. It's outrageous. You know, they have the most toxic prisons like in the country. They put them next to phosphate mines, military bases, and landfills. You know, the care there is atrocious. And this is even from Department of Justice, which is also a partner in the incarceration industry. You know, this is even with their statistics and investigation. So it's basically a matter of political will and power to force anything out of their concessions. And as our job on the outside as a movement is to basically continue to delegitimize their voice whatsoever. And we do that at IWOC by basically raising up prisoner voices themselves by maintaining contact.
There's a call to action today. Talk about phones up.
Absolutely. Like, especially because of this level of retaliation and the letters we're getting, we're trying to protect and shine a light on all this dirt that's being done. Today, it's a call to basically shut down the offices of the Secretary of Prisons, Julie Jones, as well as regional directors. And basically, a phones app is basically an action. It's not like signing a petition that can get thrown away. You basically keep the calls coming all day, and you basically take over their offices with sheer bedlam. You know, and this has a direct effect on the how free they feel, what the hand they can play against these prisoners with retaliation. And it's incredibly important today as well, because last night we just found out Kevin Rashid Johnson, a very influential and high-profile political prisoner within the system, so dangerous for his political activity that he's shuttled from state to state. He is not a federal prisoner. His initial offense was in Virginia, moved to West Virginia, moved to Texas. Now he was in Florida. He's now facing incite to riot disciplinary reports, basically taking away even more of his privileges. They brought him up on charges just because he wrote an article about Florida conditions called Florida's Laying It Down. It was published in the Bayview. They're claiming he's inciting people to riot, even though it was published on the internet. Prisoners have no access to the internet in Florida. He's inciting riot to fellow prisoners. He's held in complete isolation. Whenever he exits his cell, he's in waist and chains, you know, and ankle shackles. How was he inciting to riot? You know, he's just another high-profile prisoner they're attacking in order to knock down the prisoners' movement. So it's very important to basically keep people calling and keep the offices shut down. And we've got a report already. Our members were up at 6 o'clock in the morning with continuous calls. Phone lines are completely busy. We've already shut down the offices of the Secretary of Prisons.
Brooke, if folks want to engage in Phone Zap, where can they go to get the names and numbers of the people that they should be calling?
It's all on our Facebook page, Oakland IWOC. They can go also to the national page, Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, or they can just shoot us an email at iwoc.oakland@gmail.com.
Brooke, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We've been speaking with Brooke from Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee.
That was an interview from KPFA Radio with a member of the Oakland Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee about Operation Push, which is a prisoner-led resistance effort in protest of slave labor and other prison conditions.
The time is presently 5:48. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. So next up, we're going to have an interview with a local organizer of the Masimati LGBTQ Film Festival that's going to be going on here in Montreal this month. And we wanted to highlight this, as we mentioned, because it is Black History Month and also because of the disproportionate impact on Black lives as a result of prison incarceration and everything to do with law enforcement. And now we want to turn our attention to the intersectionality when we're looking at how the prison system impacts Black lives. We want to look at that in a more nuanced way, in the intersectionality of how sexual orientation and gender identity also come into play. And with that, I just wanted to reflect on the story of Cece McDonald. So Cece McDonald is an African-American bi trans woman and LGBTQ activist from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and she came to national attention in June 2012 for accepting a plea bargain of 41 months for second-degree manslaughter of a man she stabbed after McDonald and her friends were assaulted outside a bar near closing time. The attack a year prior was widely seen as racist and transphobic and became physical when McDonald was struck in the face by a man's friend with an alcoholic drink, a glass, causing a bleeding gash that required stitches. According to Mother Jones, when McDonald was getting away from the bar, the man came after her and she took a pair of scissors out of her purse and turned to face him. He was stabbed in the chest and died then from the wound. McDonald said she saw how her case was progressing, so took the plea bargain rather than face the trial and to risk a possible 20-year term. According to the Bay Area Reporter, her conviction sparked outrage and was viewed by many as an act of transphobia and racism against a woman who defended herself. Although a woman, McDonald was housed in two men's prisons, and an online petition led to the State Department of Corrections administering the full regimen of hormones she needed. Her story got international attention, including in May 2013, when an Ebony article, Ebony Magazine Online article about the case won the GLAAD Media Award for Outstanding Digital Journalism article. She also received support from the transgender activist and actress Laverne Cox, who's a star of Orange is the New Black, which includes storylines about trans women of color and hate crimes. Cox says McDonald is the image she has of her OITNB character, Sophia Bursette, and that she plays Bursette as homage to McDonald. Cox also identifies with her experiences. So many times I've been harassed, and any of them could have escalated. I very easily could have been Cece. Cece was released in January 2014 after serving 19 months. She was profiled in Rolling Stone, among other publications, included as part of an Advocate's annual 40 Under 40 list. And now we're going to talk to a local Montreal organizer of Massimari. Laurent, are you there?
Yes, I'm there. Yes, hello.
Great. It's great to have you today. So today we have Laurent Lafontaine, and Laurent is an organizer of the Massimari LGBTQ Film Festival. I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the festival.
So, as you said, Massimari is an Afro LGBTQ festival in Montreal. This year we're going to celebrate our 10th edition. It will happen from February 2020 to March 3rd. And actually, Massimari has been using the power of art and image to present gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual, and transgender and queer films and documentaries. It's also, Massimari, it's also a platform to showcase local talents of our community, since we have many artistic performances before or after the screening. We invite also activists and artists to talk about major subjects and thematics that affect the LGBTQ community. And the festival is also a way to promote the culture, the LGBTQ Afro culture.
That's great.
I would like to add that in an environment where we talk a lot about the lack of diversity in our media in Montreal and in Quebec in general, so Massimari is also an answer to that lack of diversity. You know, it's the only festival for Black LGBT where those communities can see themselves in screen, represented in screen also.
Great, and thank you so much for that, introduction and sort of overview about Massimari. I was wondering if you could briefly touch on the connection between Arc-en-Ciel d'Afrique and Massimari.
Actually, African Rainbow is an organization that works for the LGBTQ community, and Massimari is a festival that is organized by that organization.
Okay, great. And how did Massimari decide to screen the film Free Cece?
So, we want to screen movie that touch a diversity of subject among the LGBTQ Afro community. We screen movie from many subjects, and why we want to screen Free Cece first is because the subject really touch us. It's a combination of many things. First, it touched the trans community, the Black trans community. So always that is a first, and also it talks also about community, the involvement of community, because the story also, see, what I like about it, it's not just a story about a woman that has been attacked also, and it's one of the rare stories we heard where a female trans woman has been attacked but survived the attack, and the documentary is about a survival, and more than that, it's about involvement in the community after, because it is a lot about she wants to give back what the community have given to her while helping her passing through her days in jail. And it is a lot of, there is also a part of the movie where they're talking about how she used art, photography to be one with herself, I would say, and to affirm herself. So there is that trend. It's a survival story. It is a story very inspiring also, and it has a positive message in the end. And the fact that it is, as I say, a movie also about giving back to the community and the involvement in our society. And also, it's a movie that put light on the subject that we don't often about in the media, the discriminations that a black LGBTQ people can face, but in that case, the trans black female, because the story like this, if black trans woman who has been murdered attack on the street, there is many of that, and most of them had tragic ending. So it's not, sadly, it's not the only thing new with Free CC movie is that it's one of the way where she survived. So we wanted to enlighten that reality that the multiple discrimination people can face also.
Great.
So it's a big combination of those themes that make we choose CC.
Right.
Because I would say there were other stories about black trans women we could have selected, but the fact that if CC has a more, it's more than just the attack, it's also about the inspire people, we chose that.
Yes, that's really important. Thank you for pointing that out. And I just wanted to remind our viewers that Free CC will be screened at Never Apart on Friday 23rd, the 23rd of February at 7 p.m. It'll be followed by a panel discussion with two black trans women from Montreal, which will be How Do We Navigate the World as Black Trans Women? And Free CC will also be preceded by another short fiction feature about a trans woman directed by a Concordia student, Giovanna Olmos. So I just wanted to thank you so much for giving us that overview. The last thing I just wanted to ask you is, how do you think CC's story encapsulates the combined impact that LGBTQ people of color face as individuals and communities? I know you mentioned communities, so as a result of the oppressive impact of racism, transphobia, and homophobia, I know you mentioned that there were also other stories that you could have focused on, but you decided to focus on CC's because of the community aspect and because it was positive and because CC actually lived. So I was just wondering if you wanted to touch on that or had anything to add in that regard.
The only thing I could have heard is that it's interesting to see the intersectionality of the discrimination. For example, in the society in general, black people would have faced racism. And in the society in general, also trans people has to face transphobia. And in the case of CC, it's the way that the system has find her guilty. It's not a first also. Even though we heard many stories in USA where white people, when they played the legitimate defense, I don't know how to say that in English, they are set free. But in the case of CC, it's kind of she has been punished because she has survived the attack. Because many times we heard cases where trans people are attacked, but there are no people that have been accused. And you can see the intersectionality of discrimination now, the fact that she is black, usually black people are targeted as being not victims, but as being more criminal, and trans people are not targeted also as victims, but as people that are danger and marginal in the community. So the intersectional of both make them more isolated, because in the black community, you can be isolated also because you are homosexual and because you are trans, that you feel that isolation, but you feel that isolation also in the society at large. So,
right. So yes. So there's all of those like different impacts, sort of like a trilingual, like a you know, three different impacts, or maybe even more, depending on how you look at it, all impacting. And so I think that's really great that Masamadi and the organizers decided to do a screening of Free CC, because it's really